everyone, my name is Zach Redrup, this is the It's Not A Phase podcast, and on this episode I'm joined by singer-songwriter and former Reuben frontman, Jamie Lenman. We talk all about his new album, The Atheist, why he picked that as the title for the record, some of the samples that feature on the album, the recent reissue of Reuben's debut EP, Pilot, his upcoming third Lenmania festival, and loads more. Now, if you enjoyed this or any other episode of the podcast and you want to show your support, there's a few ways that you can do that. Number one, leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to this. It takes just a few seconds and it really does help. Number two, share this on your social media, whether that be Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, wherever. Or number three, if you want to go the extra mile, you can pay a little bit each month to join the Patreon, and in return you'll get access to episodes early along with some of our perks, or you can pick up some merch from the store. All the links to that and the podcast socials where you can follow us can be found at itsnotaphase.co.uk. That's itsnotaphase.co.uk. And now with all that out of the way, let's jump right into this week's episode of It's Not A Phase. What's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me on this episode of It's Not A Phase, where I'm joined by Jamie Lenman. How are you doing, man?
Yes, very good, Zach. Nice to talk to you again. Reminiscing about Manchester and all days and all that. I mean, I've given it away, haven't I? We're talking about Manchester. Maybe we'll plug that later down the line. Come on.
Yeah, but Manchester's, well, from what I've read, is your favourite city. Is that true? Or one of them?
I do love Manchester, and I love coming to play. I mean, I don't want to reel off a list of favourite cities because some cities might have their feelings hurt, right? But I will say that, you know, pretty much since day one when I was touring with the band, but more since I've been touring by myself as a solo act, Manchester has really stood out for me. I think because with the band, we just played so many cities, and on an occasions, I genuinely didn't know what city I was in. I know that's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason because you're just doing so many shows. Whereas by the time I sort of slowed a little bit down when I became a solo act, and then I noticed like, oh shit, every time you go to Manchester, it fucking just goes off. So that's really stuck in my heart, so to speak. So I'm always excited about coming to Manchester, and more so now that it's Len Manchester,
the third one as well. So And you know, I've seen you like so many times come to Manchester, because actually my first gig was actually a Reuben gig. It was when you were touring, I think you were promoting Blame Thrower at the time. Wow. You played in Academy 3, and yeah. I think you had, I always pronounce it wrong, is it Engerica or Engerica?
Engerica. Yeah. I remember that gig specifically because at that gig I saw the aftermath, sorry to go real dark on you, the aftermath of a racist attack in the streets of Manchester, which then became the lyrics to We're All Going Home in an Ambulance.
Right.
There's a couple of skinhead boys strolling about. It was absolutely terrifying. So that was that gig. So that was your first gig. Happy occasion for you, me, the witness to some hideous street violence. Awful. But yeah, that's that song. That gig was that song.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a nice story.
No, it's not. I mean, that's what your brain does to you when you get older. Your memories link to certain neurons in your brain link to certain things, and they just come out of the bag, whether they're nice or nasty. It was awful. I mean, I remember the gig being good, but I was shook up, and I discussed it with Dave from Engerica about how terrified I was. And he said to me, well, did you say anything? And I was like, no, I thought they were going to kill me. I was petrified. And he said, well, then it'll just keep happening because no one says anything. And I was like, oh, man. So that was a real learning moment. And I immediately went back out and tried to find the guys. No, I didn't. But yeah, it was a lot to think about in that show. God, we went in real heavy. I'm sorry.
Right at the beginning, yeah. But I mean, I was saying, I've seen you so many times in Manchester, and it all like different kind of venues, like say Academy 3, Club Academy, I think was the last time you played in as Reuben in Manchester.
I remember that show as well.
Yeah, and then Gorilla as well, which was your first solo gig, I think, when you had like the heavy.
No, we did, you know? We did Night and Day first. My first,
Night and Day.
Ever gig. Oh no, not my first ever gig, but I think it was the first night of the tour.
Right.
The band was Night and Day. And then we did Gorilla, which was great as well.
So many different places.
So many, but it's a great city. There's venues everywhere.
Yeah. You can't tell right now because it's only a few days in, but I'm doing November this month.
Okay.
I've always noticed your tash is always pretty dashing. What do you do to take care of it?
I just let it roam. No, that's not true. I do trim. Every now and then I'll trim. Right. And I don't, you know, I don't wax every day. It's like maybe if you're going to set your hair, you see ladies from the 1950s, whatever, and they've got their hair set in those marvelous waves and whatever, but they're not doing that every day.
No.
They're doing it on a special day when they're going out, and it's the same for a moustache. You might not wax it every day, but if it's a special occasion, yeah, you'll wax it up and you give it a bit of a trim.
What kind of wax do you use?
I don't know. Do you know what? It is funny, isn't it? Do you remember that band, the 80s Matchbox Beeline Disaster?
I do remember them, yeah.
I did a show in Liverpool a couple of years ago, and the singer, Guy, I think is the singer, I'd met him back in the day, and again, it, I think we almost got into a fight. I think he was maybe, his experience was being enhanced by certain outside factors, and I was not aware of this. And so we almost got into a ruck. But then I met him again in the kitchen of a pub in Liverpool, and he was as sweet as pie. He was very friendly and obviously had no recollection of this previous altercation, and why would he? And he, in fact, he said to me, he looked at me up and down, because he looks very different these days as well. And he said, did you used to have like dyed black hair and glasses? And I was like, yeah, I did. Yeah. So he's obviously got this misty memory somewhere of me out of the mist at the Kerrang Awards or whatever. And then he said, hey, I've got a present for you. And he gave me a little tub of moustache wax. So I'm still using Guy's moustache wax that I got of him, because I don't use it very often. So that'll last me a long time.
Okay.
But yeah, it's rock and roll moustache wax from one rock singer to another.
Yeah, so that's a bit strange that he's just out of the blue just giving you that wax. But
I think maybe like he got it and tried. I don't think it was new. I think he'd like tried it and maybe didn't like it. And he's like, I'm just going to chuck this in the bin. He's like, oh, I'll give it to this guy. Great. I'll take it. Thanks, Guy.
One man's trash is another's treasure. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Now, talking about the new album that's coming out, The Atheist, how are you feeling about finally getting this out there?
Oh, relieved, yeah, because it's taken a long time. I mean, it's taken a long time conceptually anyway, because you know, I've been trying to get it out for a while. And I say this about all my albums. I've had about, you know, 5 or 6 album concepts knocking around in the sort of album queue. And every time we go in and make a record, I sort of discuss it with the label and the producer and be like, how about we make this kind of album? Or how about we make this kind of album? And The Atheist, the sort of, although it wasn't always called that, the sort of slightly mellower, more indie, certainly poppier, less angular kind of record, has been in that queue since before Devolver. So back in 2016, when we were making that, that part of the discussions was, hey, I've got these sort of slightly mellower songs. We could do those. And I think it's Space that said, no, we need to do something a bit harder. And so I said, cool. But generally, yeah, every record that comes along, we talk about making it. So to finally have its time is a great relief. But then since I made it, even it's been quite a journey to get it out there, because there were various plans in place when I went into the studio in January that then fell apart. And the first sort of 3 or 4 months of the year were concerned with like bringing that all back up to speed with the label and the press offices. And I changed a lot of my team. One of my managers is no longer with me, you know, so it was a completely different landscape. I had to sort of build it up from scratch.
Right.
With this album in the bank, which was quite frustrating because, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was ready to go. So I had to wait for the other pieces. That's sort of par the course when you make a record, really. There's a lot of waiting. So when it finally comes out, for me, when the record comes out, it's like the end of the process. For everyone else, it's the start. You know, for the public, it's the start of the process. That's the first, well, maybe that you get the singles, you get a taste, but it's only when you get the record that you can really like, and you can familiarize yourself. And then you come to see the shows, the album tour, the festivals, whatever. But for me, it's weird because when it's released, that feels like an ending for me.
Right.
And then I sort of have to go out and sing all the songs, which I enjoy doing, but that's a weird little coda for me, for the artist. I don't know how other people feel like that. So yeah, I'm nearing completion, shall we say. I'm very excited about the 25th. 25th? Yeah, 25th.
Yeah, 25th.
A couple of weeks till it comes out.
And you went to, was it the Chapel Studios with Mark Roberts to record at the start of the year?
Yes, the old Chapel in Chichester. Yeah, had a wonderful time.
What was it like recording with him when working with him on this record?
He's great. He's very methodical and I'm very demanding. So he was able, we sort of worked up a compromise where he did most of his work while I was asleep, because we stayed over, which I've never done before. We did residential just for a week. And it was great because he could take his time, you know, without me breathing over his shoulder. But there were bits where I was breathing over his shoulder. I think on the last, on the very last day of mixing, we got close to pissing each other off. And I thought, oh, I've used the last ounce of his patience there to get out. But for the rest of the time, he was, as most producers have to be, good producers.
Right.
A nearly inexhaustible well of patience. Only on the last day did I scrape the bottom of that patience barrel. And then I said, okay, that's fine. That'll do. See you later.
Yeah.
He's great. You know, I adore him as a person, and I love his work.
Is it right that you recorded, this is kind of like the first time you've kind of recorded, obviously, the vocals, the guitars, bass, and the drums yourself?
And the drums, yeah. This is the first record. I should qualify that because, of course, I sing and I play the guitars and everything else, but this is the first record I did the drums on.
Right.
Which was another long-held ambition. And I wanted to do that for Devolver, actually. I said, look, I think I could probably drum this. And Space was like, nah, get a real drummer. And I was like, okay, fine. And he was right. And DK was absolutely the right man for the job. But I was confident that by the time, you know, even it was still a little bit of a stretch. There's nothing that complex on The Atheist drum-wise. There's some tasty little bits, though, that I'm quite proud of. But it was more, because it was more about serving the songs, it wasn't so much about, you know, big fills or complex beats, that things like, certainly back in the band, I felt like the drums were the main instrument. You know, I would write the drums first, and Guy and I would spend hours obsessing over every single beat. Me and John would go in afterwards and fit around the drums. This time, you know, I wrote the guitars first. I thought about the drums later. And yeah, I feel like I was able to serve the songs in that respect. You know, what would you call it? A worthy performance? It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to put that record on and be like, listen to the drums on this. I mean, but on the other hand, that, you know, there's something to say for that, for just holding down a beat and not being too flashy. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to like metal bands, at least, you know, they kind of think that, not all of them, I'm not generalizing here, but some like the Elitists kind of think like technicality equates good song, whereas it doesn't.
No, I've never really been that kind of person. Even back in the band, we knew that we were sort of cheating, really. And that was what made it exciting, was that we weren't fucking Fall of Troy, you know? We were us. We were these three kids from Farnborough, still trying to write songs like, you know, Ambulance was like, you can hear on something like Ambulance on their third record, the wheels are about to come off this thing at any second. And that, for me, that's what makes it thrilling.
But even on those early Ruben records, like, there's some technicality in there. Like, if you list, like, I don't know from your perspective, but the opening guitar riff for Fall of the Bastille, that's not simple.
How does it go? What, Fall of the Bastille? What, how does it? I can't even remember how it goes. I'll take your word for it. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, yeah. You can go back to it afterwards. And
sure, I will.
And you can correct me if I'm wrong. So why did you settle on The Atheist as the title for the album?
Well, I wanted something strong, and I wanted it to make a statement about myself. And I thought it was kind of neat that if you say it on one line, like Jamie Lemon, The Atheist, it's like saying who I am. It's like, right. Jamie Lemon, you know, Jamie Lemon, The Atheist.
Right.
I think it's cool. I think it's good if an album title can make a statement about yourself. I mean, Devolver sort of talked about the music, and Shuffle talked about the music. King of Clubs is about me, because it was sort of a half joke in that, like, I'm never going to play stadiums, I'm going to stay playing clubs, which is fine with me. King of Clubs, that was a little bit of a joke. But Jamie Lemon, The Atheist, I like that. But I also wanted to sort of promote atheism, or myself as an atheist, in terms of being a positive thing. Like, this isn't, number one, this record is not about atheism at all. And number two, I'm not seeking to promote the concept of atheism at all, but I like the idea that you could see a record called The Atheist and see those beautiful, light, bright colors and listen to the songs and hear that they're positive and think, oh, hey, sounds like this guy's doing pretty good without God, you know?
Yeah.
I think as soon as someone says they're an atheist, you get images of, you know, angry people like Dawkins and Gervais, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas for me, the whole thing about being an atheist is that it's the opposite of that. There's like no worries. It's like freeing yourself from all these bizarre rules that other people have put onto you. And for me, it's a source of happiness and loss of anxiety. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I guess some people kind of think you need to have kind of a religious blueprint to go off of to have a moral compass, which isn't true.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can get this stuff anyway, can't you? It's like saying you need to eat meat for certain minerals or whatever, but you can actually just get vitamin complexes. Although that's not actually true, is it? There's some minerals that you can't get without eating flesh, and you have to make a choice there. I've gone into a whole different path here. But veganism and vegetarianism, they're also like life choices, how you want to live your life, and a sort of a guide. And I guess atheism, doesn't really have a guide. You'd make it up for yourself, which is what I feel comfy with. Some people need a guide. Hey ho, I hope that works for you.
Yeah, as long as like you're not hurting anyone, I guess it doesn't really matter what you believe in. But if you're like kind of supporting atheism, then it's kind of like you don't know there's an afterlife, so that means you want
No, atheism, I'm pretty fucking sure there isn't. That's my point. I
to.
think agnosticism is people who are like, hey, maybe, maybe not. Atheism is like, no, fuck that noise, man. You know, there's nothing after we die. There's just blankness and emptiness, just a cold, wet earth.
So it's kind of like talking about existence, which you also touched on with the track Devolver on the album, because you're kind of talking about I'm kind of insignificant, but that's doesn't really mean anything. We're all kind of on the same playing field here.
Yeah, it's freeing. Yeah, you're right. There's a couple of tracks on Devolver that dealt with it. Devolver is one, and then Personal as well, about how God figures into that is another part of it. A lot of my songs have sort of touched on that, but you're right about Devolver saying, look, I'm just a little tiny, insignificant blob, and actually that's really nice. That's really nice. And there's a speech I managed to there's a speech at the end of the at the sorry at the start of the last track, which was originally called The Atheist, and then when I decided I want to call the album The Atheist, I changed the name to War of Doubt. But it's from a film called Bad Boy Bubby by a guy called Rolf de Heer, an Australian director, and the speech is by an industrial capitalist who is talking to the main character of the film, and he says something in the lines of, you know, we don't live, but our atoms move about in a way that gives us, you know, life and consciousness. And if we don't live, then equally we don't die. Our atoms just rearrange themselves. That's literally what he says. And when I heard that, I was 15, 16, and it was a lightning rod moment for me. And it was completely freeing, because before then, especially in my teenage years, you're trying to work out what the fuck is going on with everything. I'd been attending church, Christian church, to desperately grab onto any kind of meaning, and nothing they would give me. I mean, they tried and they were nice. Nothing they could give me made any kind of sense. All of it clashed hideously with what I knew about logic and science. Even though science is always changing its mind anyway. But as soon as I heard that, as soon as I heard this guy explain it in those terms, like, there is no death because there is no life. We get a lucky period when our atoms hang out together. Great. You know, enjoy. And then they'll fuck off and they'll become grass and they'll become sludge and they'll become slime. And there's no real loss. Or, as Eric Idle once said, you come from nothing, you go to nothing, what are you lost? Nothing. So that's how I, that really helped me. And from that moment, I was free of all those anxieties and hang-ups.
And in contrast to King of Clubs, which came out in 2020 in
Yeah.
the midst of the lockdowns because of the pandemic and stuff, and it was quite like a aggressive and abrasive record for the most part.
Yeah.
Do you feel like with Atheist, at least sonically, that's kind of a lot lighter and more uplifting? Do you feel like you kind of like needed to get that aggression out with King of Clubs for the Atheist to exist?
Oh, most definitely, absolutely. Because I was working on The Atheist before King of Clubs started. In fact, I'd made a couple of the recordings before King of Clubs, and I was talking to people about it. And as I was talking to them about it, I was saying, "Listen, this is what I'm going to do for my next proper big album. But hold on, because before then, I've got some unfinished business. I'm going to put out this EP because it was just an EP at the time. Some really gnarly shit." And then we can get back to the main business. And then King of Clubs was only supposed to be a little thing. You know, this has been well documented, but got bigger. It turned into like a mini album. And then because of the pandemic, it had to sort of sustain 2 whole years of work, really. And it's remarkable that we were able to wring 2 years of content, shall we say, it's a bit of a dirty word, out of King of Clubs, because geez, it's only 7 tracks, you know. But I did acoustic versions. I made a video for every single one of the tracks. We did an acoustic tour. We did an electric tour. We did all the live streams. So yeah, it was really was not fair to lump all that 2 years of work on 7 fucking songs. But all the while, I knew that shit, as soon as this is over, I got to get back to that other record I was making, you know.
Yeah.
So King of Clubs, even though it doesn't look like it, sort of butted in the middle. Yeah, he
Yeah.
interrupted that.
So this is kind of something that I'm kind of contest with a little bit internally. What would you say is the difference between an EP and a mini album?
Number of tracks. Anything up to 6 tracks is an EP. 7 tracks and over, 7 to 9 tracks is a, in fact, you know, 7 or 8 tracks is a mini album. You can have an album that's 9 tracks. I will accept an album of 9 tracks. So 5 or 6 tracks, that's an EP. 7 or 8 tracks, that's a mini album. 9 and over, that's a regular album.
And what about when you have these kind of like post-metal bands who have three songs that last nearly an hour and they call it an album?
Yeah, that's fine. Anything, well, because I looked into this obviously when I was releasing King of Clubs about what the parameters for an album are. I think it is anything over half an hour.
Right, okay.
As a full-length album. And the limitations for an EP aren't quite so clear. But yeah, as long as what you're doing is over half an hour's length, you can call that an album. And I think, yeah, you can have a three-track album and each track is 12 minutes. That can be an album. I mean, I sort of got a bit loose when we were promoting King of Clubs. I started calling it an album just because it was easier rather than saying all the time. Because to me, it felt like, you know, like I just said, you know, we got 2 years out of it and I didn't get bored. You know, every time you went back to it as a well of something to highlight or pick up or expand, it gave it. And I felt like within seven tracks, it sort of was as nourishing as something like an album, only just shorter. It is a mini album. Well, I sort of, you know, I count it as my fourth album, you know, and beyond the music, it had its own aesthetic. It had its own philosophy. It was a complete statement. You know, it was supposed to be just a four-track EP. And if it had been, that would have been a lot thinner and there's no way we could have wrung so much stuff out of it. But I think, yeah, you could call it an album. I call it my fourth album, but really it's a mini album.
Like you say, you did so much off the back of it. Like you say, the live stream where you brought in guests on each of the tracks to kind of give it a different kind of breath of life.
Sure. It's like a whole period, you know, a 2 year period. If you see photos of me and Jacko in like black shirts, black trousers and white braces, you can be like, oh, that's King of Clubs. You know, that wasn't just some bullshit they tossed off. It was a whole thing.
So how much of The Atheist was written before King of Clubs came about? Because I think, was it Bad Friend that you kind of like tore it? Well, you played that as early as 2018, right?
Yeah. So maybe half of it. In any record I make, some of the songs will be like decades old. Like the track Deep Down, that's from 20 years ago, minimum. I was trying to convince Ruben to play that 20 years ago. I'm sure we even jammed it out, but it just never made the cut. And My Anchor, which is maybe track six, I think, I wrote that for Muscle Memory, but it didn't fit because it was too rocking for the soft side and it just wasn't rocking enough for the heavy side. But when you think about things like, and then, yeah, Bad Friend is sort of Devolver period or just after Devolver. But then things like Hospital Tree, that's very new. Talk Hard, Lena, they're all like brand spanking new. The War of Doubt is actually, I was jamming that with Ruben on the last ever Ruben tour, on that tour that you would have seen in the Club Academy. I was sort of, we were jamming that out in Soundcheck's War of Doubt, you know, what would become War of Doubt, just that bass riff and the guitar riff.
Yeah.
So half of the songs have come from like all through my career, and maybe the last bunch of them, maybe five or six of them, have just come fresh out of the gate, you know, and they tend to be the ones that I'm most excited about. Right. I think I was writing this Is All There Is around Shuffle Time. I remember making Jacko play that riff, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, just to see if it would work when we were at a shuffle session. And he was like, the fuck? I just learned all these shuffle songs. Don't have me playing the new record now. So they all come from over the last 20 years. Yeah.
Right, right. Do you ever get kind of restless, you know, when you're kind of playing these songs that you're kind of really eager to record and put out there, but you've got to wait X amount of years? Or do you kind of enjoy test driving them when you're touring live?
Well, it's both. I mean, I get really restless, and I had to stop myself from putting a song from the next record into this touring set list because I've already got two more albums written. You know, it took a long
time.
And I'm fucking bored of these songs, you know, that I'm rehearsing with Jack and Jen, and those poor guys, you know, we'll be in the rehearsal. We spent like an hour on a completely new song for a completely new record the other day just because we'd finished up the rehearsals for the tour, and we had now. I was like, hey, you want to hear something new? Let's try this. You do this, you do that. But it was wild, you know. So I'm really restless, and I have to physically stop myself from, because even, you know, I did two shows on Monday and Tuesday this week, and I've got two more the week after next. That still, the record isn't even out, and it won't be by that time. And we're playing like nine songs off the new album. You know, seven of which no one has ever heard. You might have heard the two singles, and the other seven are completely new. It's not even like the album's come out and this is the newest stuff. It's like we've not even heard these on the radio or on a record or anything. So then to really take the piss and play stuff that's not even been recorded yet, I can't go that far. So I have to sort of stop myself from moving forward. I just moved so quickly in my brain.
Well, there was this band, I don't know if you've heard them, they're called Psycho Sinner. Didn't have any albums released, and then on one day they released 9 albums, which just seems overload to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I'd love to do that. I'd love to put out 2 albums on one day. I mean, I guess I did with Muscle Memory, and there was discussion at some point, should we make this 2 separate albums that would come out on the same day? And that would have been pretty punk. And maybe I might do that. You know, I've got lots of stuff.
Well, you kind of had like that. It was like a bonus track of sorts where you put Muscle and Memory together, the songs.
Yeah.
And that was because when I was getting like the press releases for it, they were like, oh, it's a 23 song album. And I kept on looking at the track list. I was like, 11 and 11 makes 22. I don't think
you've got to do the maths. Only few people figured that out, man.
Yeah. Well, that's nearly 10 years old now, isn't it? Muscle Memory next year will be 10 years old.
It will, yeah.
Long time.
I can't believe it. It feels like 70 lifetimes, but yeah.
Crazy, man. Crazy. With the song Bad Friends, you know, obviously the title suggests that the song's about, you know, people who can't take advantage of their side of a friendship or relationship.
Yeah.
And there's what sounds like voicemail excerpts within the song. Yeah. I assume they were recorded specifically for the track.
They were, yes. It was very, it was really amazing, actually. I knew that, because the song is about relationships that I've been in. This is the thing, you know, I have had bad friends, but I've also been a bad friend, you know, unknowingly. And so it's about sort of looking at yourself and thinking, oh, shit, am I the bad friend? So I'd been in those relationships, but also people I knew had been in those relationships. And I knew that my friend Ashley had been in a controlling relationship. She had a bad friend. And so I asked her to send me just a voice note of her talking about it. And she did it exactly right, because it had to, I wanted it to sound like a voicemail.
Yeah.
Well, not like a voicemail, but I wanted it to be a confession. But I'm asking this real person. I couldn't like write a script and get an actor to do it.
Yeah.
It had to be completely real. And Ashley's not an actor. So I had to sort of say, listen, just think about how that made you feel and tell me how it made you feel into the voice note. And don't be afraid to like get emotional and take your time. Just put everything in the voice note and then I'll take bits of it and I'll put it in the song.
Right.
She'd heard the song and she loved the song and she knew how it related to her and to me and to, you know, my wife, who is our mutual friend. And she just, it was amazing. And I had to stop myself. I nearly put the whole 3-minute thing on its own track because it was all so incredible and really brave and really insightful. And choosing just the little snippets that would tell the story the best was really tough because it was all just stunning. So yeah, but that's a real person talking about her real experiences, unscripted, just in the moment. And it's quite phenomenal. I'm glad you picked it out.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I think, you know, if you're getting someone who's, you could say it's not scripted, it's a genuine experience, an unfortunate experience, but I guess it makes the song more genuine and obviously the emotion that you're putting across in the track.
I hope so, yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned the sample on Worn Out. And then you've also got samples on the intro track and the outro track. Where did they come from?
Well, they all come from the same film. They come from the film Bad Boy Bobby by Rolf de Heer. It was really only that speech, that long speech that the industrialists make. And they're in a factory at the time, which is why you get that machine noise in the background. That was really important to me to get that on the start of War of Doubt over that long intro. Because the lyrics in War of Doubt are quite minimal. But that speech beforehand sort of tells you what the song's about. And then to have the main character, Bobby, in the middle say, it's the duty of all human beings to think God out of existence. You know, that if I could get that tattooed on me, you know. And since I was 15, I've carried that with me. So to have him in that little gap say that, amazing. But then on the start of This Is All There Is, I suddenly thought, because because I've seen Bad Boy Bobby so many times. This is one of my favorite films of all time. When I watched through it, because there was a few quotes that I thought about using, there's a few amazing bits and bobs. I mean, the whole film is incredible. But I watched it again with like a sort of a fine-tooth comb to note down where little bits that I might want to use came in. And then right at the end of the film, when I'd got all my quotes that I wanted noted down, there's a scene right at the end where Bobby's band play a club. He's sort of this Forrest Gump-esque figure that through his travels in the world in Australia, through every echelon of society, he ends up in a band. sort of doing bizarre spoken word stuff as this character, Pop, who is an amalgam of his father, but various people he meets. He ends up being a sort of a performance artist without even really trying. And at the end of the film, the idea is that his band have got really popular because of his amazing honesty. And there's a great scene where this bar is filled and someone's selling all the merchandise, which is what you can hear. And then people start shouting, "Where be Pop? Where be Pop?" And the band's about to come on and it's so exciting. And I thought, oh man, I could be that. What if that was my band? Yeah. What if we had this at the start of my record? So people are clamoring, "Where be Pop?" And all of a sudden, you know, the band comes in the movie, it's Pop's band that come in. But on the record, it's my band that comes in. But then I just thought that was such a great linking, because then you hear Bobby Pop at the end of the record talk about God in that respect. So it was just beautiful, a little bookend to it. And then getting in touch with Rolf, the director, which was quite difficult because he's hard to track down. When I finally got hold of him, he was so gracious about the whole thing. You know, it's an absolute dream come true. You hear these records with like samples from huge Hollywood movies on them, and you think, God, how do they swing that?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, my equivalent of that would be this movie, Bad Boy Bobby, that shaped me. And so to get that on the record is just like, for me, it's unbelievable. That and, you know, and Ashley's testimony, I just cannot believe my good fortune in getting these incredible people on my record. I can't take any credit for that. Those are their bits, you know?
Yeah. It's usually, from what I've heard from other bands, like getting the clearance for certain samples from movies and TV shows and whatever it may be. Oh, God. Sometimes be like the hardest bit for a record.
Oh, it takes so long and you've got a team of lawyers and yeah, it's a nightmare. And, you know, if I'd have reached out and Rolf had just been like, nah, or his team had been like, nope, I'd have been like, well, there you go. Would have been nice. Yeah. And I didn't really expect it would happen, but I thought, you know, don't ask, don't get. And I did ask and I did get, man.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you've got quite a big catalogue of music now. Obviously, you'll have this new album, which means you've got even more songs to play with.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're playing your solo stuff. You play some Ruben songs. You do a few covers as well. When it comes to composing a set list, how do you even go about doing that nowadays? I just imagine it gets even tougher and tougher as the more releases come out.
Well, it's weird. I mean, it's opened up a lot, but it's also sort of closed down a lot. It's odd because it was always challenging. When you bring out a record, it doesn't necessarily mean that, hey, you've suddenly got 12 more songs you can play, because some of them might rely very heavily on, say, a string section, or some of them. I always wondered how Biffy were going to do I Just Wish We All Could Be Tray, whatever that one is off Infinity Land, is it?
Yeah,
then and then I saw them do it and I was like, oh, that's how you do it. Certain things that you could possibly say are a bit of studio creation. You know, the Beatles are famous for that. Songs that you just can't do live. There's always a couple of them on my records. So straight away that counts out a couple of them. And then by the time that I was playing with just a drummer, you know, anything where the bass would leave the guitar, I had to sort of count that out because I couldn't really do it. So it was always, it wasn't as if you suddenly had another unexplored world of stuff. You still only had a certain amount of tunes. But now I've got a second guitarist in the band. I've got Jen playing guitar. It sort of works the other way, because if like Jacko and I are going to play The Future Is Dead or Waterloo Teeth, there's nothing for Jen to do. She'd just be standing there going, doo, doo, doo. And in one, you know, in one track we got it, Television Is Not Your Life, that we're doing, she just plays the tambourine for most of it.
Right.
There's no point in just having her doubling my guitar. And in fact, the tambourine is fucking essential. And it's great that she's there to do it. But there are songs where it's just the bass, the guitar and drums. And it would sort of be a bit stupid to just have Jen doubling my guitar. So now I've got Jen, I'm trying to focus more on songs that I couldn't have done with just two players. So, which is really refreshing and amazing. There is a lot more emphasis this time on the material from The Atheist. As I've said, you know, we suddenly got a set with like 9 songs from the new record, which I've never done before. You know, I really like these tracks and they all have like 3-part harmonies and they've all got these intricate guitar parts that Jen is filling in, and they go over, you know, to go out and to play. Like when we did Download, we played only new material. We didn't even have a single out. We played half an hour of songs that no one had ever heard live before, ever. And it still worked. And people were like, hey, great. People were singing along.
It's a bold move.
Sometimes you got to make it. It was either that or go out and do a bunch of shit from King of Clubs like we did the previous 2 years.
Yeah.
You would hear about that. And it would have been like, oh, Jamie Lemon was also there. So either we fucking shit the bed or we take the crown. either way, it's something to talk about rather than just like, yeah, yeah, I saw Jamie Lemon do the fucking, you know, I don't want to be your friend, who gives a shit. So yeah, we had to do something and paid off.
And you took the crown instead of shit in the bed.
Yeah, shat the crown.
Have you ever considered, I guess from what you've just said, that might not really be possible, but have you ever thought about maybe doing a fan voted set list, which kind of then eliminates you having to think about it at all?
Yeah, of course. I think we did do a fan voted set. I did a fan voted set list for the second Lem Mania of acoustic stuff, because that's fine. I can play whatever you want acoustic wise. Well, actually, within reason, because some of them, you know, someone asked for like Return of the Jedi, although I think I did do Return of the Jedi acoustic on one of those live streams, but it was a funny thing.
Yeah.
That's the trouble, is that if you, first of all, it'd just be like 20 Ruben songs, and I'd be like, God damn. Well, maybe not actually, because that was what I was expecting for the Lem Mania thing, and actually it was quite an even spread. But yeah, people would want to hear like the weird ones, wouldn't they? They'd want Return of the Jedi, and they'd want... Fall of the Bastille, and all that would be like a fucking nightmare.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Or like the really
weird ones, or
the deep dive ones, kind of like, I don't know, like Liz and Slow or something like that.
Exactly. And they wouldn't make like a great set. They'd make a great set for fucking Gary there, the one guy who voted, But in terms of, you know, people, record listeners don't always know exactly what makes a great set. And that's a skill that you have to learn gig by gig. 25 hard touring years. So although it would be fun, and I saw Metallica do one and it was great, I'm not ruling it out, but there'd have to be certain caveats. It'd have to be like pick from this buffet menu. And I think that's what we did for the Lem Mania thing. So I'll bear it in mind, but it comes with a lot of hidden factors, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you mentioned before Jen joining the live band. What do you think she's like to help change and evolve things on a live front for you that you didn't have before with just the two of you?
Well, someone said, I think my sound engineer said she makes it more dynamic, which I was impressed by. And if they meant she sings extra vocals and plays extra guitar, then yeah, you're right.
She does do that.
Yeah, she does. It's just great. You know, it's just great to have her there. It's just great to have her as a vibe. It's great to have her as like an extra set of ears on what works and what doesn't, because, you know, I'm a big fan of her music in the same way that I'm a big fan of Jacko's music. So, you know, I couldn't have just got in someone that, you know, I didn't know or I didn't already, you know, respect music wise. She just adds a whole another layer. I mean, I'm still calling all the shots, but we can feel things out together and make decisions on stuff that might or might not work. So that's very helpful in that period. And she's just a good vibe to have around, you know.
Yeah.
Nice to add to the touring team.
Yeah. And briefly speaking on Ruben, you put out the pilot EP again recently with extended with the extra tracks from back when you guys were called Angel a long time ago.
Mm.
How do you kind of feel about when you kind of look back at songs like that, which, you know, those ones are over 20 years old now?
It's funny because, do you know what? I was about to say that the songs on Pilot are really the only ones that I, you know, cringe a bit at.
Right.
That's true. There's some cringy stuff on Race Car and even later. You know, I've said before that the first album that I was like totally happy with was In Nothing We Trust. And before that, there's areas where I'm a bit like, I might change that or not. And I guess the earlier you go, the more you come in for those kind of feelings. I would stand by Pilot if you know what it is, which is, you know, it's the first release, you know, it's an EP, but it's essentially a demo, you know, although we meant it, the original five tracks, we meant them to be released, but we made them in the same way as we would have made one of our demos. And it's a school band. I think that's quite important for people to understand that what they're listening to is three school kids who were at school together. I think actually we made it in the summer just after Mark and John left, but I was still in the same school we were in. That's our school band on that record. And yet, you know, they're quite accomplished. It's more the lyrics that bother me and continue to bother me throughout my career. But yeah, the songs are pretty good. I mean, like I say, I don't listen to Pilot that much. We didn't have that much control over the production because we were young. We didn't know what we were doing. We just took everything for granted. And the engineer says, you have to do it like this. And we'd be like, okay. But weirdly, we had them remastered because we had to get it on the vinyl. When they sent me the test pressings of the vinyl, I put it on just because you've got to listen through once to make sure there's no clicks and pops that you can sell it to people. It's fucking rocking. And I genuinely found myself, because I was doing some work at the same time, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, like a clip would kick and I'd be like, this is sick. So I was quite surprised at how well it stood up.
Not bad for a school kid.
Not bad for a school kid. Yeah. So I think the pilot is sort of the furthest I would be willing to go back. But this is because you mentioned the fact that the B-side is demos that we did when we were called Angel. But we were called Angel when we recorded Pilot. We changed our name just before it came out. So technically, the band you hear on side A and side B of that, now it's an album because it's got 10 tracks. They were called Angel at the time, but they were Ruben. But we changed our name because we wanted this to be page one of our biography. Do you know what I mean? We'd done demos before and we were like, fine. We put them out as Angel. We didn't bother, you know, retrofitting that. But because we wanted Pilot to be a definite statement, this is where our band begins, everyone. We realized like a couple of weeks before, oh shit, there's a million bands called Angel, obviously.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it would have got lost, right? That was how we thought about it. So we wanted at the time to start our discography with Pilot. And so therefore I have to stand by it. And I do stand by it. And I think it's cool because now you can put that in your, you know, your Ruben record collection. You thought it was only like three records big. Guess what? There's another one that you can post in at the start that sort of tells a bit more of the story. It's always bothered me because I know everyone likes Race Car and I like it too. But people, they tend to think about that as the start of the story.
Yeah.
When actually, for me, it's like halfway along because we were a band for like 4 years before that came out. It took so long for that record to get made that I know it's, you know, de facto our debut record, but it doesn't really tell the story. And if you listen to that album as like a debut record, you could be mistaken for thinking, the fuck is this? You know, it sounds to me, it sounds like a second or even a third record.
Yeah.
Pilot sounds like a first album. That's the Bleach, you know what I mean? So that's what I get out of re-releasing it. I'm sorry, but I've spent so long talking about that, but there's lots to talk about, you know?
No, it's fine. And I don't know if this is why it's called Pilot, but is it kind of in the sense of, you know, have a pilot episode of a TV show?
Absolutely. That would then be the first one. Yeah, Pilot. You send it out first. That's why we called it Pilot, because it was the first one. Nice one. I'd forgotten about that, but you're right. That's why.
And do you ever listen to stuff pre-Pilot? Me versus You,
Someone brought that up the other day. Someone, because we were talking about Pilot, and I was like, it was the first thing, and they were like, what about Me versus You? And I was like, oh, God. Yeah, those demos are out there, but I would discourage people from listening to them. That really is like, there's a school band and there's like a kid band. I'm not cussing them, because even if you listen to even something like Me versus You, which is lit, I think that's the very first thing we did with Jason. As a three-piece, as something that you could recognize as a version of Ruben. You know, God, I was fucking 15 or whatever, maybe younger. The songs themselves, you know, they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Verse, chorus, finish, stop. But to me, I find those embarrassing because I hadn't learned how to be myself. I was just pretending to be Kurt Cobain or whatever. You know, the irony, this fucking kid from Surrey trying to be a grunge icon. And the lyrics are just dread nonsense, you know. I hadn't learnt to talk about my own feelings. And Pilot is interesting, and that's the start of that. Some of the songs are still a little bit like nonsense poems in the same way that Kurt would write. But some of them really do reflect how I felt at the time. Something like Crimson was actually my real feelings, and Words from Ruben was my real feelings. Whereas maybe Alpha Sigma 7 is a sort of a nonsense poem, you know?
Yeah.
And with that comes certain things that I wish I hadn't said. But hey, I was a kid, man, so I wouldn't really look too hard at those. They don't bear microscopic study. Pilot, that's fine, but don't go beyond that.
Like you say, when you did the stuff pre-Pilot, you were literally a kid, not only trying to find out how to write songs and record songs, but also find out who you are as a person.
You're exactly right. And you never expect... We made those recordings for ourselves, really. And we only really quite half-heartedly disseminated them as tapes. I think we made like 5 tapes of Me versus You because we sort of knew like this isn't really for anyone else to hear. Yeah. Those were really us trying to get used to studio craft. You know, we would go in. I think we made Me versus You over one evening, and it was. And when I say evening, I mean they locked us in from 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. at the studios in Soho University. Because they're like, right, well, no one's using it throughout the night because everyone's asleep. You can go in then. We're like, fuck, we made a whole record one night. So they were about us learning. Yeah, they're not really for anyone else's ears. When you later go to stuff like Betrayed, I heard you mention Betrayed, and Hand Over Fist, those recordings, again, were more to sort of get gigs, you know. Again, yeah, yeah. We never like sold those on the merch desk or anything. They were more about getting gigs. So even though those are slightly more accomplished, they still weren't ever meant for public consumption, really. So to find out, I mean, I know they're on the fucking website. I don't know whose fucking idea that was.
Not yours.
Maybe I'll tag them down. But for that 15-year-old kid to think, man, people are going to be listening to these songs when you're 40, I think even he would have been like, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, yeah. You know, how would that happen? That's not cool. I mean, it's fine. If people can accept them as what they are, which is, you know, pages of a diary from a child's notebook, then fine. But they were never meant for public consumption, let alone decades of study, you know. So if you're interested, fine, seek them out, enjoy them, but I'd never like point people towards them, hey, listen to this.
This is where I started.
Yeah, right, fine.
Yeah. Well, moving to like the current day, or well, yeah, the future, should I say. We talked about it before the interview started, Len Mania 3 in Manchester. Yeah. How are you feeling about doing your third all-day festival?
I'm fucking psyched. I am pumped, because if I'm honest, the first two, we didn't really get them right. The first Len Mania was fucking wild. It was sort of arranged by the venue manager. It was spearheaded by them. And I was like, yeah, sounds great. And I had been trying to get an all-day up and running for quite a while, actually. And then when someone said, hey, do you want to come to my venue? We've got two stages. I was like, oh, great. We can really make this happen. But I wasn't able to enjoy it because I was sort of stuck backstage all day doing like press and interview. Right. And it's the same. I used to book like the same when you book a band you really like to support you on tour. You forget that like when they're on is when you need to be doing your warm ups, you know? So you never get to see them. So I didn't get to see any of the bands at Len Mania. And actually, I fucked my voice with the acoustic set, which I hope doesn't happen again. I mean, I didn't enjoy the headline set. And like, I know you can see from the video, there was people like stage diving all over my pedals. I found the first Len Mania quite stressful.
Right.
And the second Len Mania wasn't really an all-dayer in the truest sense of the word. Yeah, I did get to pick all the bands. But like I say, for me, Len Mania has to be an all-dayer. Two stages, you go from one band to the next, and that's the spirit of the thing. Len Mania 2 was an attempt to sort of stretch that format. You know, we took over a stage at Trees, which was fucking cool. And we did a few gigs and sort of like a run up, but right, it sort of strayed from the path. I think now Len Mania 3, that's my chance to really get it bang on. And I feel like we've got a good chance because, you know, the setup in the Manchester venue is great. There's like a real gig venue and then there's like a bar. And we've got like a load of bands that people have heard of, like St. Agnes and Sick Joy. But then we've got a load of bands that no one's heard of, like Rad Pit. And that's, again, what Len Mania is about. It's like not only, oh, hey, here's some bands from the scene that you might already dig. It's also like, hey, here's some bands that you've never fucking heard. Come check them out. That's absolutely part of what it is. I'm just jazzed. I'm so excited. And to do it, and also, this is very much the whole point, because I'd said, even though it's just a bad joke, hey, we should do it in Manchester and call it Len Manchester, you know, then we can. Or like, hey, did you realize Race Car is Race Car Backwards? Great, that's the title. You know, all these things, yeah, as bad jokes. But to do it in Manchester is a really great way of saying, hey, music industry, it's not just fucking London, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a southerner. I've always lived in the south, but I married a girl from Durham. And since I was fifth fucking teen, I've been driving all the way up and down this country, you know, discovering that shit, man, the country looks different wherever you go. You go to Birmingham, it's different. You go up to Glasgow, it's different. They're, you know, they're different countries, really. The first time I went to Newcastle, I had to check I had the right money.
That, oh, was, really?
That was how foreign it felt to me. I thought, oh shit, I didn't get any money changed. Geordies, how many Geordies is this? No, we use pounds. But that's the beautiful thing. So to be able, yeah, to say, look, guys, shift your glance from London for a fucking microsecond. There's stuff going on elsewhere. Even if maybe the, now I'm saying this, I'm thinking, oh shit, how many of the bands are actually from Manchester on the bill? Maybe that doesn't matter as much as saying, hey, we're going to focus this around Manchester. And the guys that ran the venue, when we were talking about it, they were like, great, great, great. So when's the London date? And we were like, there is no London date. It is Manchester. That's it. This is the main one. And they were like, wow, because they thought, oh, we'll be playing second fiddle to London like we always fucking are. Not this time, buddy. Manchester all the way.
And it's a good, like, the way the venue's set up for people who haven't been there and listening. Is it Club Academy and then it's the bar, isn't it? So it's literally just a stairwell in between the two rooms. So it's easy to get from one stage to the other.
Great, because we've only given you 5 minutes. I've done the layout of the timings to squeeze everyone into 7 hours.
Right.
5 minutes to walk that staircase. So I hope it's not leg day or there's a big queue.
Yeah.
No one's going to be playing over each other. And then fucking Lamb of God are in like number one. So I hope we can hear ourselves over there. Immense chugathon.
So other than obviously The Atheist coming out on November 25th and Lemania on December 18th, what else is planned that you can talk about at least for the rest of 2022 and 2023?
Well, 2022, I don't know when this is coming out, but I've still got two more dates to do in this little sort of, I guess it's a warm-up tour for Le Manchester, even though we couldn't tell people about Le Manchester when we released the dates. I've still got the 16th and the 17th of November, I think, in St. Albans and Hartford, which is amazing because I don't think I've ever played either of those towns, never even been to Hartford. So what awaits me there? I've no idea. We did Tunbridge Wells a couple of nights ago. And again, I don't think I've ever played that as a solo act. I did a birthday party, but I think it was a sort of a quasi private event. So to go there and be like, okay, who's going to turn up? Oh, you guys are great. Nice to see you. So I'll be fascinated to see who turns up in St. Albans and Hartford next week. But then, yeah, it's all about the run up. Well, shit. I mean, I said it's all about, yeah, we got the album coming out. We got Lemania. I got another single coming out in between the next dates and the album, just as sort of like a week ahead of the album to give everyone a taste. So there's that. That's going to be exciting. I've got to make a video and all the assets for that. So I'm fucking, and then I'm turning 40. Next week I'm turning 40. So that's a whole week of absolute fucking mayhem. My 40th birthday party, which is going to make ancient Rome look like a fucking knitting club. So that's happening. I've been building. In fact, I'm building a giant wooden cake for my wife to jump out of for the party. And then I've got a Beatles tribute band come in, and then there's going to be like a pizza buffet. It's going to be completely fucking insane. So that's my birthday all next week. That's the biggest event in the calendar. You know, wow. My album can go fuck itself. It's my birthday. I'm excited about. Yeah.
Yes, sounds like you're going all out for your birthday.
4-0, what are you going to do, man? I've been saving up for 4 decades for this one. Yeah. My mom insisted that I had a Freddie Mercury tribute for my wedding anniversary a few years back. And then my mom insisted that I book a Beatles band for my 40th, just in case she's dead before my 50th. I can't wait.
Outlook, but you know.
Well, she's getting on, you know. She said, I can't wait until you're 50th. You better book the Beatles for the 40th. So I was like, can do, mom. So yep. Beatles for mom. And then who knows? I might book a fucking Ruben tribute for my 50th. That'd be fucking hilarious, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Los Skeletos. Yeah.
Los Skeletos. Yeah. I think those guys are still going.
Yeah.
I got a message from one of the, I think the singer did a video for a talk card the other day. I think it's him. Yeah. They're still around.
Yeah. Give him a call. I'm sure they'll do it.
Yeah. Bones don't rot, man.
Happy birthday for then. I know it's obviously a few days away, so.
I'll take it. Thank you.
Yep. Yep. Before I let you go, have you got any final words, anything else you want to say?
Well, I guess just thanks for your support, Zach, throughout the years. Was it Dead Press you used to work for?
Yeah, yeah, I used to run Dead Press, and then that last year, last August.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm really pleased, you know, when they said, here's the interview with Zach, I was like, oh, shit, great. You know, it's great to have that link with someone, and to know that you're going to be there at Le Manchester is really, you know, it's huge for me. So thanks for providing that continuity, man. I'll be looking out for your smiley face in the audience.
Yeah, of course, man. Well, thank you very much for your time. Best of luck with the album. I'm sure it's going to go down well.
Cheers, pal. Okay, well, take care.
Yep, you too.
Bye now.
Bye. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please consider supporting the podcast in any way that you can. We have a Patreon where you can get access to each episode a week early, along with some other perks, a merch store, or you can leave a review wherever you're listening to this. You can also follow me on social media or subscribe to the newsletter, where I'll send out each episode to you via email, along with regular playlists. All of this can be found at itsnotaphase.co.uk. That's itsnotaphase.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and remember, it's not a phase, it's a lifestyle.